We are in Arcadia, or at least Arcadia, according to Gilbert and Sullivan. This is an idyllic land inhabited by shepherds and shepherdesses, but also by strange old-fashioned creatures with special powers, members of the House of Lords. There are fairies here, too. And unlike the peers, the fairies are forever young and forever beautiful. However, these poor fairies, or peeries, as they are somewhat confusingly known, are suffering something of a crisis of identity. The problem is that Iolanthe, the life and soul of Fairyland, has been banished for 25 years by the Queen of the Fairies for the heinous crime of marrying a mortal. She should have received the death penalty. But the Queen took Iolanthe's previous good character into account and commuted the sentence to lifelong exile. Iolanthe had to leave her husband and promise never to communicate with him again. She has been living at the bottom of a stream ever since, with a group of frogs. Her fellow fairies argue that her punishment has gone on for long enough. Life surely doesn't mean life in this case. The queen misses Iolanthe too, and claims that Iolanthe taught her to curl up in a buttercup and swing on a cobweb. Given that the queen is the least likely of an airy fairy you've ever seen, this does seem strange. But she is persuaded to summon Iolanthe back. Iolanthe admits that she not only married a mortal, but also had a son called Strephon. He is now a handsome shepherd, living handily nearby in Arcadia. And he has the rare distinction of being half fairy and half mortal. His proud mother says that he is fairy down to the waist, and then all man below that. (Clears throat) and the fairies agree that this seems to be the best way round.
Good morrow, good mother. Good mother, good morrow. By some means or other, pray banish your sorrow. Join me, on telling my bosom is swelling, so join in a measure expressive of pleasure. For I'm to be married today, today. Yes, I'm to be married today.
Yes, he's to be married today, today. Yes, he's to be married today.
Strephon explains that he's going to marry a young shepherdess, Phyllis. But she is, unfortunately, a ward of court, whose fate must be determined by the Lord Chancellor of England. Lord Chancellors do tend to believe that they run the whole country. And this one seems to hold sway even in Arcadia. He refuses to allow Phyllis to marry Strephon. This decision is based on solid legal principles, such as the fact that the elderly Chancellor quite fancies the girl himself. Whatever else happens, he is certainly not going to let her marry a mere shepherd. The Queen of the Fairies advises Strephon to choose a more intellectual career and become a Member of Parliament. Well, even fairies make mistakes. The Queen just happens to have a couple of parliamentary constituencies at her disposal and can rig Strephon's election. This sort of thing only happens in opera, of course. And poor Strephon is awfully worried that his split personality is unsuitable for the House of Commons. He confesses that his head is conservative, but his legs are radical, and he won't know which way to vote. The Queen says this will not be a problem. There is a third way. Phyllis is worried by Strephon's bold decision to marry her without the Lord Chancellor's permission. This carries a sentence of a lifetime of penal servitude, and she asks him to wait for 2 years when she will come of age. He produces a mirror, tells her to look at herself, and asks if it is rational to expect him to wait 2 years. No, you're quite right, she replies. It's asking too much.
By the Embody the law. The constitutional guardian, I, a pretty young lord in chancery, all very agreeable girls, and none over the age of 21. A pleasant observation for a rather susceptible chancellor.
A pleasant observation for a rather susceptible chancellor.
But though the compliment implied inflates me with legitimate pride, it nevertheless can't be denied that it has its inconvenient side. For I'm not so old and not so plain, and I'm quite prepared to marry again. But there'd be the deuce to pay the lords if I fell in love with one of my wards. It should rather prize my temper, for I'm such a susceptible chancellor.
Rather prize my temper, for I'm such a susceptible chancellor.
Marry a ward must come to me for my accord, and in my court I sit all day, feeling agreeable girls away. With one for him, and one for he, and one for you, and one for ye, and one for thou, and one for thee. But never, oh never, a one for me. Oh, it seems exasperating for a highly susceptible chancellor.
It seems exasperating for a highly susceptible chancellor.
here are the members of the House of Lords extolling the virtues of the hereditary system. And here is the Lord Chancellor explaining his demanding role in the framework of the Constitution. The peers address the serious legislative business of the day, which is asking the Lord Chancellor to allow Phyllis to marry one of them. The Chancellor has to admit that he really wants to marry his ward himself, and explains that although this would, of course, be a perfectly proper course of action, it might be misinterpreted as a conflict of interest. He therefore waives his claim to Phyllis, complaining about how rigorous standards are for those in public life. Yes, indeed. No whiff of marital scandal can be attached to a Lord Chancellor. He is congratulated on this ethical policy by Lords Tallulah and Lord Mount Ararat, two of the most blue-blooded and therefore perhaps not the brightest members of the House of Lords. They seize their opportunity and summon Phyllis to attend the Assembly of Peers.
My well-loved Lord and guardian dear, who summoned me and here.
Oh, wretch!
Look.
treat with virtuous scorn the well-connected. High ranking calls no shame, we boast an equal claim, with him of a humble name to be respected. Blue blood, when virtuous love is sought, thy power is not, though dating from the blood, blue blood, ah,
we
Then I went to the bar as a very young man. Said I to myself, said I, I'll work on a new and original plan. Said I to myself, said I, I'll never assume that a rogue or a thief is a gentleman worthy implicit belief, because his attorney has sent me a brief. Said I to myself, said I. Ere I go into court, I will read my brief through. Said I to myself, said I, and I'll never take work I'm unable to do. Said I to myself, said I, my learned profession I'll never disgrace by taking a fee with a grin on my face when I haven't been there to attend to the case. Said I to myself, said I. I'll never throw dust in a juryman's eye. Said I to myself, said I, or hoodwink a judge who is not overwise. Said I to myself, said I, or assume that the witness is summoned in force and exchequer King's Bench common pleas for divorce and perjured themselves as a matter of course. Said I to myself, said I. In other professions in which men engage, said I to myself, said I,
I'm a the church.
Or the stage. Said I to myself, said I, professional license is carried too far. Your chance of promotion will certainly mar, and I fancy the rule might apply to the bar. Said I to myself, said I.
Strephon is in serious trouble, and his mother, Iolanthe, promises to ask the fairy queen to help him out. But Strephon has rather foolishly forgotten to explain to his fiancée, Phyllis, that his mother is extremely beautiful and looks about 17. When Phyllis sees the two of them embracing, she gets the wrong idea. So do all the peers, based presumably upon their own experience in such matters. Strephon's protestations of innocence are greeted with derision, and Phyllis angrily rejects him, deciding to marry Lord Talala or Lord Mount Ararat instead. And she doesn't care which. The Queen of the Fury, Queen of the Fairies. The queen of the fairies is furious. It could be Gilbert, couldn't it? Anyway, she's furious at this slight to fairydom and vows to revenge herself on the peers by sending Strephon into Parliament. He will be a new leader, with a huge majority, with magical charm, with a wide smile, and a mission to reform the House of Lords. It sounds awfully unlikely, doesn't it?
To chase the gloom away on thee I'll call.
What?
I think I heard him say that on a rainy day, to while the time away on her he'd call.
You think we heard him say that on a rainy day, to while the time away on her he'd call.
he say?
I heard the minx remark, she'd meet him after dark inside St. James's Park and give him one.
The minx remark, she meets him after dark inside St. James's Park and give him one.
Across it's not so bad, my heart so sore and sad, may very soon be glad as far as sun. Tempest break my bark, if I should need a rock, she'll give me one, give me one.
That shakes the listening earth.
The joke is good extremely and justifies our mirth.
This gentleman is seen with a maid of 17 and taking of its dolce far niente. And wonders he the chief, for he asks us to believe she's his mother and he's nearly 25.
Recollect yourself, I pray, and be careful what you say, as the ancient Romans said, pestilente. For I really do not see how so young a girl could be the mother of a man as 25.
My lord, of evidence I have no dearth. She is, has been, my mother from my birth. In pain. Upon her lap I lay, with infant food she moistened my clay. Had she withheld the succor she supplied, by hunger quelled your Strephon might have died.
Had that refreshment been denied, our Strephon might have died.
Had that refreshment been denied, indeed our Strephon might have died.
But as she's not his mother, it appears, why weep his heart unnecessary tears? And by what law should we so joyously rejoice because our Strephon did not die? Oh, rather let us pipe on, because our Strephon did not die.
That's very true, let's pipe on, because our Strephon did.
Hear me, Phyllis.
Oh, God, you did deceive me.
Hear me, Phyllis.
My love has gone be talking to another.
Oh, fine, this heaven is a rogue.
I tell her very plainly that the lady is my mother.
Tell her,
she won't believe my statement and declares we must be parted, because on a career of double dealing I have started, then gives her answer one of these and leaves me broken hearted.
Tell her,
a cruel one to separate two lovers from each other.
Oh, fine, this heaven is not a rogue.
You've done me no justice, for the lady is his mother.
Tell her,
that fable pass me service turn as well as any other. I didn't see her face, but if they fondle one another, and she's but 17, I don't believe it was his mother.
I have often had a use for a thoroughbred excuse of a sudden, which is English for repente. But of all I've ever heard, this is much the most absurd, for she's 17 and he is 25.
She is 17 and he is only 25. Oh, five, 7 is a goal.
Now listen, play to me, for this paradox will be carried nobody at all contradicente. Her age upon the date of his birth was minus 8, if she's 17, and he is 25.
She is 17, and he is only 25.
The position of his mother is an
utter bit of
folly. Oh,
fine,
a 7 is a
goal.
Go away, madam, I should say, madam, you obey, madam, shocking taste. It is rude, madam, to intrude, madam, with your brood, madam, brazen face. You come here, madam, interfere, madam, with a peer, madam, I am one. You're aware, madam, what you dare, madam, simply care, madam, and ignore.
By these puny mortals, I will launch from fairy portals all the most terrific thunders in my armory of wonders.
Sure, they launch terrific thunders all the most terrific thunders. teach respectful speech, your attitude to bury, your body not so airy, your manner arbitrary, are out of place when face to face with an influential fairy.
On this verger, I'm in a nice corner of hasty tone with dames unknown. I ought to be more chary. It seems that she's a fairy from Anderson's library, and I took her for the proprietor of a lady's seminary.
When next your houses do assemble, you may tremble.
I'm going to go to the hospital. cruel Strephon, pity your Phyllis. Easy prey now for that pair of red-hot, blue-blooded lords, Mount Ararat and Tolola, sung by Ashley Holland and John Graham Hall. The end of Act One of Gilbert and Sullivan's opera Iolanthe, in this concert performance given at the Royal Albert Hall as part of this summer's proms. Ian Richardson is telling us the tale, as written by Ian Hislop. Sarah Connolly is singing the title role of Iolanthe, Claire Rutter is Phyllis, William Daisley Strephon, and Richard Stewart, the Lord Chancellor. Anne-Marie Owens is the Queen of the Fairies, or possibly Queen of the Furies, and the BBC Singers and the BBC Concert Orchestra are conducted by Jane Glover. Well, this prom performance from last August was the first time that the conductor, Jane Glover, had presided over Iolanthe, but as she told my colleague Christopher Cook at the time, she's no stranger to the work.
It is the first time I've conducted it. I have to confess that rather many moons ago, I did actually sing the Queen of the Fairies in a production in Oxford directed by Mel Smith, and it was huge fun. And I think I must have played in it at some point too in my oboist days, but this is certainly the first time I've conducted it.
What do you particularly like about this of all Sullivan scores?
Well, actually, I have to confess to being a sort of quiet Sullivan groupie. I think he's a wonderful orchestrator, and I think most conductors would agree with you about that. I mean, whether you like Gilbert and Sullivan or not, and I think the world is divided into people who like it and people who don't, and the people are very sort of extreme about this. They like it a lot or they hate it a lot. I certainly like it a lot. I admire him hugely for his orchestration and his the fact that, you know, he pastiches so many things. You know, there's Rossini, there's Mendelssohn, there's Mozart, there's earlier stuff with the a cappella singing, there's Puccini, there's a bit of everything, and he does it so well. And I think that the secret for us is actually to take all this pastiche very seriously and to play the Rossini bits as if they're Rossini and play the Mendelssohn bits as if they're Mendelssohn, and then suddenly they fizz off the page, you know.
The conductor, Jane Glover. Act 2 of this proms production of Iolanthe begins with an arresting little drama. Private Willis, the bass Jonathan Vera, who guards the House of Lords, rushes on stage in a hard hat, swinging the ceremonial mace above his head. A Tarzan of a man, he comes to put the politicians in their place in one of the opera's most celebrated numbers. As for the assembled peers and peeries, the members of the chorus, women wearing yellow chrysanthemums and the men blue sashes, well, between Acts 1 and 2, they've found time to cross the floor en masse, or at least swap places on the stage behind the orchestra. Clearly their differences are not entirely irreconcilable. So now for Act 2 of Iolanthe, it's time to rejoin the narrator, Ian Richardson.
We are in the Palace of Westminster, which is bathed in moonlight. Romance is in the air, as it is so often at this time of night in the corridors of power. Private Willis, the sentry on duty, is not so much a romantic as an intellectual, and he is using his time to reflect on the merits and disadvantages of the traditional two-party system in British politics. In his day, of course, it was just the right-wing Tories and the middle-of-the-road Liberals. There was no such thing then as a left-wing Labour Party. Yes, it's very difficult for you to imagine, I know.
Thank you.
night long a chap remains on sentry go to chase monotony. He exercises of his brains, that is, assuming that he's got any. For never nurtured in the lap of luxury, yet I admonish you, I am an intellectual chap, and think of things that would astonish you. I often think it's comical, fa-la-la, fa-la-la, how nature always does contrive, fa-la-la-la, that every boy and every girl that's born into the world alive is either a little liberal or else a little conservative. Fa-la-la-la, fa-la-la, is either a little liberal or else a little conservative. Fa-la-la. When in that house MPs divide, if they've a brain and cerebellum too, they've got to leave that brain outside and vote just as their leaders tell them to. But then the prospect of a lot of tall MPs in close proximity, all thinking for themselves, is what no man can face with equanimity. Then let's rejoice with a loud fa-la, fa-la-la, fa-la-la, how nature always does contrive, fa-la-la-la, that every boy and every girl that's born into the world alive is either a little liberal or else a little conservative. Fa-la-la, fa-la-la, is either a little liberal or else a little conservative.
Here's a pretty kettle of fish.
Strephon has been reforming the Constitution and has introduced his bill to throw open the peerage to competitive examination. Lord Mount Ararat is upset and says, "Not that I've got anything against brains. I often wish I had some myself." No, he is worried that if all the clever people are in the House of Lords, then only stupid people will go into the House of Commons. How wrong can you be? Still, this is a novel defense of the hereditary second chamber, and one which we should perhaps take more seriously. Mount Ararat declares, "If there is an institution in Great Britain which is not susceptible of any improvement at all, it is the House of Peers." Well, he has, of course, no idea that this statement could be considered ambiguous.
To intellectual eminence or scholarship sublime. Yet Britain won her proudest place in good Queen Bess's glorious days. Yet Britain won her proudest place in good Queen Bess's glorious days. When Wellington thrashed Bonaparte, as every child can tell, the House of Peers throughout the war did nothing in particular, and did it very well. Yet Britain set the world ablaze in good King George's glorious days. Yet Britain set the world ablaze in good King George's glorious days. And while the House of Peers withholds its legislative hand, and noble statesmen do not itch to interfere in matters which they do not understand. As bright will shine Great Britain's rays as in King George's glorious days. As bright will shine Great Britain's rays as in King George's glorious days.
Don't suppose a tearful life forgiveness shows. Oh no, your disrespectful sneers. Don't go. Call forth indignant tears. Don't go. You break our laws, you are our foe. We cry because we hate you so. Don't go. You very wicked peers, you wicked peers. Don't go.
You break our laws, you are our foe. We cry because we hate you so. You know. You very wicked peers, you wicked peers. Don't go.
Our disrespectful sneers, ha ha, pour forth indignant tears, ha ha, if that's the case, my dears.
Don't go!
We'll go.
The Queen of the Fairies discovers her entourage weakening and reminds them that the law is absolute. The penalty for marrying a mortal is death. The fairies, like the Lord Chancellor, are very keen on absolute laws, until they apply to them. It is not death, surely, just to think about marrying a mortal. The Queen tells them to subdue their desires as she does. Of course, she too is susceptible to the manly charms of a fellow like, say, Private Willis. But she controls her passions. She has a metaphorical cold shower. However, she wonders to herself if even the London Fire Brigade, under the great Victorian hero Captain Shaw, could put out the fires of her love.
Captain Shaw, tie off to love and death.
Phyllis is miserable, despite being simultaneously engaged to Lord Tallulah and Lord Mount Ararat, since they are both titled, rich, and unattractive. There is nothing to choose between them. But if one of them were to reject his title and redistribute his estates among the peasantry, then she would accept the other one. This rather confuses the earls, who are not prepared to be quite that chivalrous. They finally agree that neither will have Phyllis, since far more important than the love for a woman is the bond of male friendship. "We were boys together," says Tallulah. "At least I was." The two peers embrace, and no one mentions fairies at all.
Not even love should rank above true friendship's name.
Then free me, mine the blame. Forget your grace and go your ways in friendship's name. In friendship's name.
Oh, many a man in friendship. But no one yet in the world so wide has yielded up a promised bride. Accept your friendship. Oh,
Lord Chancellor has been tossing and turning all night, unable to sleep and staring at his expensive new wallpaper. He has, of course, been thinking of Phyllis. And though the Lord Chancellor may appear to the public as a pompous figure making ridiculous judgments on matters he knows little about, beneath the formal wig and the traditional black silk knickerbockers, there beats a heart all too human.
Love, unrequited, robs me of my rest. Love, hopeless love, my ardent soul encumbers. Love, nightmare-like, lies heavy on my chest and weaves itself into my midnight slumber. Thank you.
awake with a dismal headache and reposes to boot my anxiety. I concede you may use any language you choose to indulge him without impropriety. For your brain is on fire, the bedclothes conspire of usual slumber to plunder you. First your counterpane goes and uncovers your toes, and your sheet sifts demurely from under you. Then the blanketing tingles, you feel like Mick's pickles, so terribly sharp is the pricking. And you're hot and you're cross and you tumble and toss till there's nothing fixed to you in the ticking. Then the bedclothes all creep to the ground in a heap and you pick them all up in a tangle. Next your pillow resigns and politely declines to remain at its usual angle. Will you get some repose in the form of a doze with hot eyeballs and head ever aching? But your slumbering teens are such horrible dreams that you very much better be waking. For you dream you're crossing the channel and passing about in a steamer from Harwich, which is something between a large bathing machine and a very small second-class carriage. And you're giving a treat, penny ice and cold meat, to a party of friends and relations. They're a ravenous horde, and they all came on board at Sloane Square and South Kensington Station. And out on that journey, you find your attorney who started that morning from Devon. He's a bit undersized, and you don't feel surprised when he tells you he's only 11. Well, you're driving like that with a singular lad. By the by, the ship's now a four-wheeler. And you're playing around games, and he calls you bad names when you tell him the tie's made the dealer. But this you can't stand, you throw up your hand, and you find you're as cold as an icicle. In your shirt and your socks, the black silver gold clocks crossing Salisbury played on a bicycle. And he and the crew are on bicycles too, which they've somehow or other invested in. And he's telling the Tars or the particulars of a company he's interested in. It's a scheme of devices to get at low prices or goods of convictions to cables, which tickle the sailors by cheating retailers as though they were all vegetables. You get a good spaceman to plant a small placement, first take off his boots with a boot tree, and his legs will take root and his fingers will shoot, and they'll blossom and bud like a fruit tree. From the green grocer tree you get grapes and green pea, cauliflower, pine, apple, and cranberries, while the pastry could plant cherry, brandy will grant apple, parsnip, three corners, and banberries. The shares are a penny, and ever so many are taken by Rothschild and Baring. And just as a few were allotted to you, you awake with a shudder, despairing. You're a regular wreck with a crick in your neck and a one-ear small for your head on the floor, and you need some pins for your solutions, and your flesh is a cream for your legs and your teeth, you cramp your toes and a fly in your nose, and some puffing your lung and a feverish tongue and a thirst and a dent, and a general sense that you haven't been sleeping in clover. But the darkness has passed and it's daylight at last, and the night has been long, ditto, my song. And thank goodness that most of them
The Chancellor's romantic dilemma is compounded by a legal one. He has to plead his case in front of himself. And he has just turned himself down. He has, as he puts it, a double capacity. Their lordships agree that this must be terrible. Let us be thankful, they say, that we are persons of no capacity whatever. Lords Tallulah and Mount Ararat then inform the Lord Chancellor that they have withdrawn their proposals to Phyllis and urge him to try again. If he makes a last submission to himself, they are sure he will somehow find in his own favour. Their lordships may be a bit dim, but they know how the law works.
If you go in, you're sure to win. Yours will be the charming maid. Be your lord, the ancient saw. Faint heart never won fair lady. Never, never, never faint heart never won fair lady. Every journey has an end. When at the worst affairs will mend. Darker on when day is nigh. Hustle your horse and don't say die. He who
shies at such a prize. He is not worth a mere lady. Be so kind to bear in mind, saint of never one fair lady.
Never, saint of never one fair lady.
While the sun shines many a hay, where a wind is there's a way. Be it a lion in his lair, and but the brave deserve the fair.
I'll take heart and make a start, though I fear the prospect shady. Much I'd spend to gain my end. Saint had never won a fair lady.
Never, saint had never won a fair lady.
Nothing venture, nothing win. Blood is thick, but water's thin. In for a penny, in for a pound, it's love that makes the world go round.
Nothing venture, nothing win. Blood is thick, but water's thin. In for a penny, in for a pound, it's love that makes the world go round.
Strephon is miserable, too. He knows that it should be fun being in Parliament with no opposition. And the chance to do whatever you like. But he is miserable and he shows signs of stress. Perhaps he needs a holiday in Tuscany. Luckily, Phyllis appears just at the right moment and he tells her everything. He explains that her mother is a fairy, which is why she looks so young, and that he is half fairy himself. Naturally, she asks... which half? And is reassured that from the waist down he is flesh and blood. He tells her that his grandmother looks as young as his mother, and so do all his aunts. I quite understand, Phyllis says. Whenever I see you kissing a very young lady, I shall know it is an elderly relative. Well, the two of them are now determined to get married before they change their minds. We'll get married first and change our minds afterwards, they agree. That is the usual course. You know, for a swain and his lover, they're surprisingly sophisticated.
Enough to tarry ere we marry, you and I. Of the feeding I inspire, you may tie her by and by. Four peers with flowing coppers press their offers. That is why I am sure we should not tarry ere we marry, you and I.
If we're weak enough to tarry ere we marry, you and I. With the more attractive maid and joven maid and lonely bride. If by chance we should be parted, broken hearted, I should die. So I think we will not tarry ere we marry, you and I.
Ah, ah,
if we weak enough to tarry, then we marry, you and I. Of the deep in my empire, you may fire, fire, fire. Of the deep in my empire, you may fire, fire, fire.
There is still a major problem in the lovelorn shape of the Lord Chancellor. And Strephon asks his mother to plead his case. Iolanthe is reluctant to do this, for the mortal whom she abandoned and vowed never to see again is none other than the Lord Chancellor himself. It is an extraordinary coincidence. The Lord Chancellor is her husband and Strephon's father. And with cruel irony, he must decide his own son's fate. Unfortunately, he has been impressed by his own latest legal submission to himself and has decreed that it would be a breach of his human rights not to let himself marry Phyllis. Things are getting desperate, so Iolanthe hides her face and begs for mercy.
My lord, a suppliant at your feet I kneel. Oh, listen to our mother's fond appeal. Hear me tonight, I come in urgent need. 'Tis for my son, young Strephon, that I plead.
Not be, for so the fates decide. Learn thou that Phyllis is my promised bride.
Lord, no, no.
It shall be so. Those who would separate us, woe betide.
My doom thy lips have spoken. I plead.
Again. thou livest.
I live. Now let me die. Once again thy vows are broken, thou thyself thy doom hast spoken.
We are now left with a scene of total misery and impending death. But never fear, this is not the end of the story. This is Gilbert and Sullivan, after all, not Puccini. The other fairies announce that if Iolanthe has to die, then so do the rest of them, because they have all just married the entire House of Lords. And they are now fairy marchionesses, duchesses, viscountesses, and baronesses. But the queen of the fairies is bound by fairy law. Every fairy shall die who marries a mortal. What can she do? Fortunately, the Lord Chancellor is an old hand at drafting legislation. He suggests inserting a single word so that the law reads, "Every fairy shall die who doesn't marry a mortal." This brilliant U-turn. A classic piece of judicial revision leaves only one problem. The queen also has to marry a mortal to avoid death. She immediately chooses the manly Private Willis, and everyone is now happy. The peers decide that they will join the fairies in Fairyland, since hereditary peers have been abolished and there is no further use for them. So, there it is. The House of Lords has been reformed, and only persons of intelligence are allowed to sit there. There are no old-fashioned aristocrats, but there are also no political time servers. No rich donors to party funds. No useful lawyers. No old school friends of the Prime Minister. And no one who could be remotely described as a crony. Well, before I leave you with this happy ending, I hear some of you complain that this is nothing more than a fairy story. Well, you might think that I couldn't possibly comment.
Make up your minds, the people.
endless series we will arrange. Happy exchange, House of Peers for House of Peers.
Peers, 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 House of Peers for House of Peers. Up in the air, sky high, free from wars, he chancery. I will be surely happier, for he's such a susceptible chancellor. Up in the air, sky high, free from wars, he chancery. He will be surely happier, for he's such a susceptible
chancellor. So one and all depart for Fairyland, and that's the end of Gilbert and Sullivan's opera Iolanthe in this performance given in August this year at the Proms. The cast was as follows. Iolanthe was sung by Sarah Connolly, Phyllis was Claire Rutter, Strephon William Daisley, the Lord Chancellor Richard Stewart, the Queen of the Fairies was Anne-Marie Owens, Lords Tallulah and Mount Ararat were John Graham Hall and Ashley Holland, Private Willis was Jonathan Vera, Celia and Layla, two of the Fairies, were Alison Smart and Lynette Alcantara. The narrator was Ian Richardson, with the script written by Ian Hislop. The semi-stage production was directed by David Edwards, and the BBC singers, chorus master Stephen Betteridge, and BBC concert orchestra leader Cynthia Fleming, were conducted by Jane Glover.